religious freedom dictates that we are allowed to speak the truth. Because again, this is what religious freedom is all about, is that we recognize the truth and we pursue it. And in pursuing it, we articulate it so that others know where it is that we're going.
And we're back, another fresh episode of the Deacon of the Dock.
And I am the deacon part of this, Deacon Mike Beauvais, and my co-host,
Dr. Thaddeus Romanski.
It is a pleasure to be here, Thaddeus.
Indeed. I think we've got a good show and a timely show today, talking about religious freedom, the concept of religious freedom, both in the American constitutional realm, but more importantly for the purposes of this program, in Catholic understanding, specifically the document from the Second Vatican Council, Dignitatis Humanae.
Yes, in the past you've heard us talk about mainly the four constitutions that came out of the Second Vatican Council, but there were numerous other documents that were ancillary to the four constitutions, and Dignitatis Humanae is one of the more important ones of that, although it does tend to borrow heavily from the other documents of Vatican II in explaining what the Church is intending to lay out because of Vatican II. And again, for the most part, the documents of Vatican II were not changing what the Church teaches. They were primarily intended to change how the Church talks about things due to the changes in the culture.
And it does also, when you said borrow from, I thought you were going to go in a slightly different direction, because it actually does borrow from, or it is shaped by, the American experience to some degree, because we know that Father John Courtney Murray, an American Jesuit, was very important in helping to draft this document.
Yes. And again, one of the things that's worth remembering is that if you look at the United States Constitution, especially yes. if you look at the First Amendment,
yes.
this is revolutionary in itself. The idea that man has freedom of a religion, that man is free to speak the truth and live the truth in their life without coercion from the government. And it's important to note that this is not present in a lot of countries.
That's true. And this entire idea for this episode was actually prompted by an article that I saw towards the end of 2022, and it was talking about steps that individuals can take to protect religious freedom in the United States today. And one of its first pieces of guidance was knowledge. Know the actual text of the First Amendment. And so just real quickly, since you mentioned the First Amendment's protection of religion, freedom of religion, it's important to point out that there's actually two components, there's two clauses that make up the First Amendment's protection of religion. There is what's known as the Free Exercise Clause, and that is that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So you have the Free Exercise Clause and then the Establishment Clause. No law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So, much as people are going to be surprised by this, the words separation of church and state are nowhere in the Constitution. They are not in the First Amendment.
As a matter of fact, I would say that the First Amendment actually says exactly the opposite, that the free exercise of religion cannot be infringed by the government, which means that any religious institution has the right to be active in society, even in the political realm. So the notion of that you can't say a prayer in government goes against the First Amendment, because the First Amendment says that my free right to exercise my religion can't be abridged. So if I would like to say a prayer, and the people that are in the same mindset as I am are free to join in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the former Cardinal Archbishop of Philadelphia, Archbishop Charles Chaput, in 2010, he gave an address at Houston Baptist University, and that place will figure importantly a little bit farther down the road in our conversation today. But he gave an address titled "The Vocation of Christians in American Public Life," and he pointed out in this address that, quote, "the modern drastic sense of the separation of church and state had little force in American consciousness until Justice Hugo Black excavated it from a private letter President Thomas Jefferson wrote in 1802 to the Danbury Baptist Association. Justice Black then used Jefferson's phrase in the Supreme Court's Everson v. Board of Education decision in 1947, end quote. And Chaput went on to point out that the Catholic bishops at that time in 1948, responded to that decision. They objected to that decision and pointed out that it had forced the nation's public institutions into a, quote, indifference to religion and the exclusion of cooperation between religion and government. And that is where we have gone since 1948.
Yes, you might say we slid down that hill at breakneck speed, because now we see things like religious institutions that have been operating for a century or more now being curtailed by the government because they refuse to change what they have always believed.
Right. And they refuse to change how they exercise their religion in civil society.
Exactly. And so, again, you know, that separation of church and state, which is not in the First Amendment, snuck in there by a Supreme Court decision, which I am quite sure never anticipated the end results of this. But as with all things, you can always foresee where something like this is going to go just by the direction it initiates.
Right.
Which brings me to humana, dignitatis humanae. The whole idea here is addressing, in part, the communist government style that was coming up throughout the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And what it's addressing is, how do we speak about religious freedom in light of what was happening in these countries?
Mm-hmm.
And so when we're talking about free exercise of religion and freedom of religion in Dignitatis Humanae, it's addressing all religions that are being oppressed by these governments. And you and I both found it fascinating that the document begins with the idea that in no way does it deny the fact that the Catholic faith is the one true faith established by Jesus Christ.
Yes, would you let me to read that
passage?
Yes, please. Okay, so this is in section one, in the second paragraph of Dignitatis Humanae. That's the Declaration on Religious Freedom. First, quote, first, the Council, the Second Vatican Council, professes its belief that God himself has made known to mankind the way in which men are to serve him and thus be saved in Christ and come to blessedness. We believe that this one true religion subsists in the Catholic and Apostolic Church, to which the Lord Jesus committed the duty of spreading it abroad among all men. Then it goes on later. On their part, all men are bound to seek the truth, especially in what concerns God and his church, and to embrace the truth they come to know and to hold fast to it, end quote. And those of our listeners who have, you know, read Lumen Gentium along with us, the Dogmatic Constitution on the Church, that last sentence should echo, it should have some echoes of Lumen Gentium in it as well.
Yes, but what I find interesting is that some of the criticism of this document were the fact that, were based on the fact that the church seemed to be equating all religions in their conversation on governments coercing people into either abandoning their religion or not being able to exercise it. And obviously from that paragraph, you can see that they start out with saying that it recognizes that there is only one true religion, mm-hmm. but that when a government suppresses any religion, it suppresses all religions. Because ultimately, it's only going to be one religion allowed that the government forms into whatever image and likeness they want.
Right. And you pointed out that then two paragraphs after the one I just quoted from, it continues and it establishes, it defines terms, and it says religious freedom, which men demand as necessary to fulfill their duty to worship God, has to do with immunity from coercion in civil society. What does that mean, Deacon Mike?
Well, that means that governments should not be in the business of coercing individuals either into a religion or out of a religion mm-hmm. in civil society. Mm-hmm. That does not mean that the Catholic Church cannot state with assurance that there is only one truth.
Mm-hmm. In fact, it says next, therefore, it leaves untouched traditional Catholic doctrine on the moral duty of men and societies toward the true religion and toward the one Church of Christ.
Yes, and this again is the emphasis in this document on the truth, the acknowledgement that truth exists and that truth is intimately related to our faith.
Mm-hmm. Over and above all this, the Council intends to develop the doctrine of recent popes on the inviolable rights of the human person and the constitutional order of society. It continues, this Vatican Council declares that the human person has a right to religious freedom. This freedom means that all men are to be immune from coercion on the part of individuals or of social groups and of any human power in such wise that no one is to be forced to act in a manner contrary to his own beliefs, whether privately or publicly, whether alone or in association with others within due limits.
And this again speaks to the primacy of the individual's conscience. And that needs clarification because from the church's perspective, this always means a well-formed conscience. If we're going to insist on being guided by our conscience, we also have an obligation to make sure that conscience is well formed and that we understand, again, the truth behind what it is that we believe, that our conscience guides us to act upon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A few more paragraphs down. It is in accordance with their dignity as persons, that is, beings endowed with reason and free will, and therefore privileged to bear personal responsibility, that all men should be at once impelled by nature, impelled, and also bound by a moral obligation to seek the truth, especially religious truth. They are also bound to adhere to the truth once it is known and to order their whole lives in accord with the demands of truth. However, men cannot discharge these obligations in a manner in keeping with their own nature unless they enjoy immunity from external coercion as well as psychological freedom.
I find that interesting because when we read this in context from 1965, to me it says something totally different from what it would say today. And in part that is because we have sort of disassociated our conscience from the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the development in our society, so much of what we choose to do, what we claim our conscience is guiding us toward, is no longer associated with the truth. It's associated with feelings.
Or the will. It's what we will.
Exactly. And it runs directly contrary to what Dignitatis Humanae intends to communicate that our conscience must be guided by that innate search for the truth that is in all mankind.
Mm-hmm. It's the situation today is Nietzschean in some respects.
Oh,
it's,
yes.
It's what I want, my will to power. That's his phrase, his famous phrase. But it's about what I desire, what I want, regardless of whether that is in accord with the good, with the beautiful, with the truth,
yes,
with my nature.
Yes. And this is, you know, again, once you disassociate your desires from the truth, there's no barrier to where they might go. And also you lose all control because what do you guide it by? What do you limit your choices by?
And also importantly, when we're talking about civil society and civil accord, if that's the rules we're going to live by of what I want, well, then what about what you want? And if what you want, you have more, if you have more power, more strength to exert and impose your will over and against my will, well, then that's how we're going to resolve disputes. It's not going to be according to the rule of law or
the truth,
a moral system, truth, what is the good.
Well, and we see
natural
this,
law.
And we see this a lot in cancel culture, is that, you know, someone states something, even if it's true, and Twitter mob or whatever shouts them down, not because it's untrue, but because it's unpopular. And so you have this disassociation from speaking the truth and speaking what is popular. Mm-hmm. And one of the things else that I was going to point out in what you said is that religious freedom dictates that we are allowed to speak the truth. Because again, this is what religious freedom is all about, is that we recognize the truth and we pursue it. And in pursuing it, we articulate it so that others know where it is that we're going. But also one of the other things is that, you know, Dignitatis Humanae speaks a lot about the common good. Mm-hmm. And in our conversation right now, that is one thing that is impossible to reach if everyone is guided by a conscience that's not guided by the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Because how do you get agreement other than what you were mentioning earlier, by the loudest and the most forceful voices, mm-hmm, overriding all else?
Yeah, we're moving into a situation where we're in effect all living by the sword, rhetorical or hopefully not
literal,
but we're all kind of living by the rhetorical sword, and we're all going to perish by the rhetorical sword, right? Or the ones that are wielding the swords now, mm-hmm, because they're creating that kind of a way of adjudicating disagreements.
Yes.
They're going to die by the sword eventually.
Yes, because ultimately, as has happened in the past, some totalitarian government or entity will ultimately dominate because we're no longer linked to the truth and we have abdicated all responsibility for the most forceful exercise of whatever is desired.
So this is very concerning for its impact on our constitutional order here in the United States, that we are, you know, we've been on a 60-year trajectory of ignoring the free exercise clause and the establishment clause and what those truly mean for the lives of religious people in this country. And we're moving, you know, we've been more governed by this strict separation of church and state, which is kind of an invention of the Supreme Court.
Yes. Well, but in addition to that, I think this document's insistence on associating the common good with the pursuit of truth,
mm-hmm,
is vitally important for our culture to read and reassess in light of the First Amendment, because I think this was part of the point of Dignitatis Humanae, is the understanding that the truth will guide you in the direction that you should go.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're looking at government right now looking to suppress statements of truth, no matter what they are, suppress them. They're suppressing religion just by the fact that they're suppressing the truth.
Right, right. And one of the, I wanted to make sure we got this in here, since we're a Catholic podcast. I think one of the ironies of this situation in the United States is that our first Catholic president, when he was a candidate, actually contributed to this confusion. Because I mentioned Houston Baptist University. Well, in 1960, when John Kennedy was on the campaign trail, he made this important campaign stop in Houston, and he spoke to a gathered assembly of Protestant ministers, the Houston Baptist Association. And in this speech, he talked about how his Catholic faith would impact his decision-making and his carrying out his constitutional obligations if he were to be elected president. And so this is a little bit long, but I'm going to read a good portion of it. Kennedy said, quote, "I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no Catholic prelate would tell the president, should he be a Catholic, how to act, and no Protestant minister would tell his parishioners for whom to vote, where no church or school or church school is granted any public funds or political preference, and where no man is denied public office merely because his religion differs from the president who might appoint him or the people who might elect him. I believe in an America that is officially neither Catholic, Protestant, nor Jewish, where no public official either requests or accepts instructions on public policy from the Pope, the National Council of Churches, or any other ecclesial source, where no religious body seeks to impose its will directly or indirectly upon the general populace or the public acts of its officials, and where religious liberty is so indivisible that an act against one church is treated as an act against all." Now, in Kennedy's defense, what he's really speaking about is more the idea that the United States is not a sectarian society where there's one religion or one sect of one religion has a predominance or a privileged or favored place. Now, if we know our American history, we know that that actually was the case,
yes.
Right? Protestant, America was a Protestant nation. America was a Protestant predominant place, and Jews and Catholics and those of other religions had to make their way against prejudice and discrimination. But I think it's pretty clear from his words there, I don't think he had any concept. I don't think he could contemplate the situation where we are now, where there's an attitude of secularism, where there is of irreligion, where the default position is no acknowledgement of religion at all, no acknowledgement of a transcendental plane, a transcendent plane. But he laid the foundation for that by those where the separation of church and state is absolute.
Yes, and what I hear when I hear that speech is that even if it is true, the church has no obligation or right to speak to someone of that faith who is in a political position. And we see this today played out, that when the church speaks and says that it is against church teaching, politicians of that religion say, well, they're not speaking for me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is a result of that, even though it's an unintended result.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I don't necessarily have, I mean, I think that's John Kennedy being a product of his time and of his, the Catholic America that he came out of, that had just won its place in the mainstream. It had just gotten its seat at the table as we're just as American as any Protestant. Jews could say the same thing coming out of World War II and the Great Depression. And then,
well, but I think
the rug was pulled out from under us, because what the mainstream was going to be changing in that very decade that he became president.
Well, but I think in a way, Dignitatis Humanae is a response to this and the proper understanding of how that should have been interpreted.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, you cannot deny the truth, even if you don't want to hear it.
So what does it's going to be interesting. Well, I don't think we've exhausted this topic, and we can probably, return to it another time. I think there's more of the Declaration on Religious Freedom that we can go through, but I'm glad that we had spoke to this topic of religious freedom. It's a term that people hear in the news, in the media a lot. And I hope we added some clarity to what the Catholic Church understands to be the content of religious freedom.
And we'll see if we can't find something else interesting to talk about, to sometimes disagree about, but always to be faithful about.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Deacon on the Dock podcast. If you've enjoyed it, please consider going to redsearadio.org/donate and supporting religious education for the domestic church.